In the 3 years that I've been NPR's justice correspondent, I have never actually interviewed justice. Until now. Justice is a French electronica duo, Gaspard Auger and Xavier de Rosnay. When they needed a band name, they wanted a word that's the same in French and English. Mayonnaise seemed a bad choice, so they went with justice. The band played a concert in Washington last week to promote their new album, and a few hours before the show, Gaspard and Xavier came into NPR studios for an interview. They're in their late 20s, and they wore skinny jeans and leather jackets. When I asked Gaspard what he had for breakfast, he said, "A good old cigarette." The band's first hit was not originally a Justice song. A few years ago, a British group released a track called Never Be Alone Again. Xavier and Gaspard entered a contest to remix the song. Xavier, the talkative one, says they were students at the time.
That was a contest organized by school radio, like a campus radio. They were sponsored by Virgin, the record label. And we just gave it a try because we were just starting to make music. We didn't know anything about music or production. So we needed like some kind of excuses or things that are easier to make than your own tracks. And that was perfect. And we've lost the contest.
You lost the contest?
Yeah. But it was okay. Like for us, it was not unfair to lose it, you know. It was not a problem. We were just like, okay, let's try to improve our skills.
And improve they did. The Justice remix of the song came out under a new title, We Are Your Friends. And soon, it was everywhere. Can you describe what exactly you did to take this song that was pretty much unremarkable and turn it into one of the biggest hits of the year?
I think it was pretty much remarkable because actually we still think that the original one is better than the one we did.
But the original one wasn't successful the way your remix was.
Yeah, but in music, timing and luck and to be like at the good place, the right moment is really important, much more than the talent or the music on itself.
There's a moment when you guys perform live where sometimes you're doing We Are Your Friends and the music cuts out and the whole audience starts chanting,
"We are your friends, you'll never be alone again, come on, 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 because we are your friends."
When you guys are on stage and hundreds or thousands of people are shouting, "We are your friends, you'll never be alone again," what does that feel like from your perspective?
Really, we really have a distance between like the music we do and how we are involved in it.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that when people are singing We Are Your Friends, this is not a message we wrote, this is just a sample we took from a song that was cool. Like for sure we feel like good and happy and excited and stuff, but then we know that it's hard to think that you are like great or a cool musician when people are singing like lyrics from a sample you took from another record.
Partly for that reason, Justice recently took a break from remixing other people's music and released their own record. The album's title, if you can call it that, is A Giant Cross. Xavier says he wanted the CD to be like a 2008 disco opera. The songs range from aggressive instrumentals to a poppy sing-along that Gaspard describes as a tribute to Michael Jackson.
The lyrics are made of Michael Jackson song titles.
Right, did you just sit down and say, how many Michael Jackson song titles can we pack into these lyrics?
It was the first time that we were writing lyrics, and it's quite hard, because English is not our native language, so to write lyrics in your non-native language is a bit tough.
So you're saying because it was difficult for you to write lyrics in English, you took Michael Jackson's song titles and made those the lyrics to the song.
It's articulated by real words, so it can sound like sentences.
I love how the lead vocalist, the kid, is just a little bit off.
Yeah. Actually, like all the singers we cast to sing the song were really young, but also really professional. That means you just bring them a score and they sing exactly what is on the score. And so we had to write like all the mistakes and the stuff on the score, so they could sing it sometimes a bit off.
You had to say, sing this a little bit flat, sing this a little bit sharp.
No, we wrote it on the score. We wrote a score, and at the end of the words, we put like some note, just a half tone up or down, so it can sound a bit like not really sharp, you know.
All the band's lyrics are in English. Xavier says that comes from growing up with American popular music.
When it's in French, we understand the lyrics, and most of the time they sound really cheesy. But they're not like more cheesy than English lyrics. You know, he's always talking about the same things.
It's just that in English you don't understand them, so it doesn't seem so cheesy.
Okay, now we do understand, but because of this habit, we just think that to write in English is like easier because you don't involve yourself as much as writing in French, because then your parents will understand them, your friends will understand them, you do understand them, you know.
The band's latest single is called DVNO. Xavier says the song is about the lame club in every country called Divino.
There are clubs that have like really a strict door policy, and you have to wear like a tie or white shirt to enter, you know.
You say this as I'm wearing a white shirt and a tie.
Yeah, but do you have the right shoes? Yeah! You can enter the Divino.
Gaspard, Xavier, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you.
Gaspard Auger and Xavier de Rosnay are the band Justice. They're touring the United States through the end of this month. To hear songs from their CD and to compare the band's remix of We Are Your Friends to the original Never Be Alone, visit our website at npr.org/music. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
Blanche DuBois, the central character of Streetcar Named Desire, is one of Tennessee Williams' most memorable characters. When she boards the streetcar that will take her to her sister Stella's home in New Orleans, Blanche knows she's headed for a place where she does not belong and where she will soon discover she is not wanted.
Can I help you, ma'am?
Well, they told me to take a streetcar named Desire and then transfer to one called Cemeteries and ride 6 blocks and get off at Pollution Fields.
Blanche DuBois is a character so rich and so complex that bringing her to life is one of acting's great challenges. In this latest installment of our series, In Character, NPR's Lynn Neary talks with some actresses who've taken on the role of Blanche.
For an actress, playing Blanche DuBois is like climbing Mount Everest. The role is both physically and emotionally demanding. Actresses talk of losing their voice, suffering bouts of depression, or having anxiety attacks while playing the part. Yet they covet the role. Glenn Close got her chance to play Blanche in 2002 under the direction of Trevor Nunn at the Royal National Theatre in London.
Well, Blanche is the center of the play. All the action happens because of her, and she's a magnificent part.
When Blanche arrives on her sister's doorstep, she is penniless and alone. A fading beauty, she's lost her job, her home, and, it will soon be revealed, her reputation. Clinging to the past, she cannot face the reality of her life. She hangs Chinese lanterns around her sister's apartment to cover up her grim surroundings and tries to use her feminine wiles against the hostility of her brother-in-law, Stanley Kowalski. The first actress to play Blanche was Jessica Tandy, who starred opposite newcomer Marlon Brando when A Streetcar Named Desire opened in 1947.
Now, what is the cost for a string of furs like that?
Why, those were a tribute from an admirer of mine.
Well, he must have a lot of admiration.
In my youth, I excited some admiration. But look at me now. Would you think it possible that I was ever considered to be attractive?
Tandy's performance is legendary. She made the role her own, even though Brando's naturalistic acting style and overt sexuality threatened to overshadow her performance. When the play was made into a film, Vivian Leigh put her own stamp on the role of Blanche.
Why, these were tributes from an admirer of mine.
He must have a lot of admiration.
Oh, in my youth, I excited some admiration, but look at me now. Would you think it possible that I was once considered to be attractive?
Every actress who has played Blanche since is aware of both those performances, which did so much to shape perceptions of the character. Yet each actress must encounter Blanche anew. Michael Kahn, now the artistic director of the Shakespeare Theater Company in Washington, D.C., directed a production of Streetcar at the MacArthur Theater in Princeton, New Jersey in the 1970s.
There's no one Hamlet. There's no one, you know, Lady Macbeth. There's no one Blanche DuBois. As a matter of fact, I think every Blanche who played it that Tennessee saw, he would tell them that they were his favorite Blanche, because each actress brought something to the role that might have been different than somebody else. And I think he liked that.
Shirley Knight starred as Blanche in the production directed by Kahn. A few years later, she did the role again because she felt she hadn't finished with the character. The second time, Knight says, she came to a new understanding of the energy Blanche brings with her from the moment she appears.
She is, from the onset, a moth that's fluttering too near to the flame, and she never stops.
It's important, says Knight, to capture that moth-like quality, to show how truly vulnerable Blanche is. Otherwise, Knight says, the audience can see Blanche as too self-centered and manipulative. If an actress gets Blanche right, Knight says, the audience will identify with her.
Because we all are sometimes insecure or petty or looking down on other people or whatever it is, you know, wanting safety. And Blanche was searching for safety, and she never had it.
One thing I do know about her, that it's the loneliest part to live through that I've ever played on the stage.
Rosemary Harris starred as Blanche in the 1973 Lincoln Center production of A Streetcar Named Desire.
And most people, even if they're unsympathetic characters like Lady Macbeth or somebody, at least she has Macbeth rooting for her, but there is nobody rooting for Blanche. And you go through that night after night, and it begins to get to you. It's very, very lonely up there.
What saves Blanche and makes her tragedy more bearable, says Harris, is her humor. Harris says too many people fail to see that parts of the play, especially some of the exchanges between Blanche and Stanley, are meant to be funny.
They're very witty. They're very funny with each other. They spar, you know, strike sparks off each other. And it's a sort of sexual, it's obviously sexual right from the very beginning, too. But it's a sexual thing with wit.
Lila Robbins, who played Blanche at Chicago's Steppenwolf Theater, agrees.
I think she just is funny because of the things that come out of her that you don't expect.
In one of the most powerful speeches in the play, Blanche tries to convince Stella to leave Stanley. In Steppenwolf's production, Robbins captured the humor in some of those lines.
He acts like an animal, has an animal's habits, eats like one, moves like one, talks like one. There's even something subhuman about him, something not quite to the stage of humanity yet.
Blanche is a character filled with contradictions, and that, Robin says, is the real challenge of the role.
As much as she wants to see beauty in life and magic and propriety and have this certain aesthetic, she's also an incredibly sensual, lonely, hungry woman. And you keep rocking back and forth between these things and trying to literally hold yourself together.
For Glenn Close, the key to Blanche is her strength. Underneath it all, says Close, Blanche is a survivor.
She is not physically strong anymore, and she's certainly emotionally and psychologically fragile. But she's not giving up. She just doesn't give up. She fights to the, I mean, she fights him at the very end. I found that very moving and a very important aspect of the character.
What did you do that for?
Oh, I could twist the broken end in your face.
But you would do that.
I would. I will if you...
A little rough house, huh? All right, let's have a little rough house.
Strong as she may be, Blanche DuBois is ultimately no match for the brute strength of Stanley Kowalski. And when her own sister refuses to believe that Stanley raped her, the delicate, moth-like Blanche is finally broken. But Glenn Close says, at the end of the play, she was still determined to show Blanche's inner strength.
It seemed right to me that when she's kind of lifted out at the end by the doctor being taken off to whatever asylum she's going to end up in, that you see her putting herself back together enough to leave with a sense of dignity because she has spent so much energy keeping herself together.
And so when Blanche DuBois holds on to the arm of the doctor who is taking her away and tells him she has always depended on the kindness of strangers, she turns her own tragedy into an unexpected moment of grace. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And on our website, we've gathered a gallery of famous Blanches plus scenes from the film. It's all at npr.org/incharacter, all one word. While you're there, you can nominate a character who's made a difference in your life. We might put your essay on the air.
And now, one side of a national issue is using a new movie to rally its cause.
I meant what I said, and I said what I meant. And an elephant's faithful 100%.
Okay, that's one of Horton the Elephant's best-known mottos, as voiced by Jim Carrey in the animated version of Dr. Seuss's Horton Hears a Who. But another Horton saying has drawn attention from anti-abortion groups. They see a message in the movie that suits their purpose, as NPR's Kim Masters reports.
In Horton Hears a Who, Horton the Elephant discovers that there's a whole town on a tiny speck that has floated his way.
I don't exactly know how to tell you this, but...
You're living on a speck.
Well, I hate to disagree with you, oh voice from the drainpipe, but I live in Whoville.
Despite skeptics on all sides, Horton is determined to protect life on the speck. A person's a person, no matter how small, he declares. When Horton said that line during the Los Angeles premiere of the film last Saturday, demonstrators who had slipped into the theater started to yell.
I thought maybe there was a nut loose in the theater or something.
That's Carl Zobel, an attorney who has represented the interests of Dr. Seuss, or Theodore Geisel, for some 40 years. After the show, Zobel saw the demonstrators handing out anti-abortion flyers that looked like movie tickets. Geisel's widow, Audrey, was there, and Zobel says none of this sat well with her.
She doesn't like people to hijack Dr. Seuss characters or material to front their own points of view.
Some anti-abortion websites say Audrey Geisel supports Planned Parenthood. Zobel says he never discussed such matters with her or her late husband, but he says the Geisels never wanted Dr. Seuss characters used for any political purpose.
People running for office like to refer to their opponent as the Grinch because it's kind of a simple-minded way to say my opponent is a mean, bad person.
In Colorado, Christy Burton represents a group working on a ballot initiative stating that life begins at conception. She says her group wasn't at the film's premiere, but is planning to show up at Denver theaters when the movie opens, not in protest, but in support of its message. That may not have pleased Dr. Seuss, but she says the group has been careful not to go too far in using his material.
Regardless of anyone's particular position, the statement, a person is a person no matter how small, certainly affirms our amendment in defining a person from the very beginning stages.
Burton says the group has no plans to disrupt the movie. They'll simply wear T-shirts bearing that Horton motto and try to gather signatures for their petition. Kim Masters, NPR News.
It was only a matter of time until a private performance by President George W. Bush made it onto YouTube.
This past Saturday, President Bush chose to sing some of his remarks at the annual Gridiron Dinner. It's supposed to be an off-the-record event with journalists. White House Press Secretary Dana Perino told the New York Times this is one leak the president doesn't mind. So here it is, his version of the green, green grass of home.
I spend my days clearing brush. I clear my head of all the fuss. The laughing fuss you made over Harriet and Brownie. Down the lane I look and here comes Scooter, finally free of the prosecutor.
President Bush singing his swan song at last Saturday's Gridiron Dinner here in Washington, D.C.
Yes, sure. Oh.